Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at Carriage Works at the 2018 Festival.
Hello! I was supposed to come out on stage halfway through that little video, so I've already totally messed this up. And I really have to, before I get things going here in this fabulous room that used to be a rail yard and way, way, way back before then used to be the stomping ground of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, who were really onto this whole getting together and talking about stories before the Sydney Writers' Festival ever had that idea ever. So before we do anything, I would like to acknowledge those great people and the care that they took of this piece of dirt. And I welcome you to it today. Thank you for being here at I nearly said Rock Quiz. You know, I have to deflate your expectations about this event because backstage I've been asked, well, how are you going to score it? What points are there going to be? How will you decide who will win? And I'm thinking, geez, all I did was steal Julia Zemiro's name, really, for this event, and I have made no other arrangements at all. So don't get overexcited about the infrastructure. Speaking of infrastructure, we do talk today to people outside this space. Thanks to Live and Local, we are going out live to Brisbane. Mulaney, can we please give a shout out to Mulaney? Thank you very much. Hey, Mulaney. Tamworth and Port Macquarie. And very happy we are to be talking to all those fine people today. Now, I'm going to introduce to you my guest lineup, and I'm going to start with the lady who's quiz name I nicked. It seems fair. I've taken advantage of her intellectual property that I call her out first. Could I please welcome Miss Julia Zemiro? Come and sit here. So Julia, of course, you'll know from Rock Quiz, from Home Delivery, first episode of her new 6th series aired this week, and it's, oh my gosh, an incredible piece of television with Rebecca Gibney. So once you've finished with this, go and watch that. She's also pashed the French president this week, so that's nice.
We didn't technically pash it all.
No, but in my retelling, you did.
Hosted an event, and he was delightful, and we spoke about all sorts of manner of business. It was great.
Which coincidentally brings us to our next guest, because this next guest was described as the most beautiful woman on Australian television by the husband of the woman who was described by the French president this week as delicious. Ladies and gentlemen, Lee Sales. Hello. Anywhere along here, please.
Thank you very much.
She's also written some books, Detainee 002, On Doubt, and she's got a new one coming out. Am I allowed to say that yet? Awkward if I'm not. Later this year, called Any Ordinary Date. The next guest I blame for climate change. That may seem harsh, but this man is responsible for the fact that at about 10:45 on any given morning, most of the cars in Sydney are only on the road because they don't want to miss the last bit of conversations. So, take it like a man, Richard Feidler. Come and join us here.
Thank you. Over there. Thank you.
I'm already pointing at you.
Thank you. I'll have dead German poets for 20, Annabelle.
You may not have got the memo about the complete lack of any scoring. System. Now, the thing is, I have disappointed your expectations about the level of detail involved in the planning of this event, but I'm about to exceed your expectations in a rather wonderful way. We have a bit of extra room on, well, one of these lounges, I don't know which it'll be, and we're going to fill it with a person who you won't have heard of. He is a composer, a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director. He's played everybody from Friar Tuck to Judas Iscariot. He was described by the Daily Telegraph in London as insanely talented. And for those of you who are thinking, holy shit, is this Tim Minchin? Yes, it is!
Tim Minchin!
I know.
I didn't realise.
Yeah, I know. What did you... Oh, and he chooses to sit next to Lee Sales. That's noted. Oh, that's fine. Oh, God. I knew this was going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. So the rules of this incredibly exciting game is that we're just going to have conversations about books. It's going to be like a great book club where you don't have to prepare, you don't have to eat the dreadful warm, drink the warm shardy that somebody, you know, maliciously brought along. You just get to sit back and listen.
I'd go a warm shardy.
Yeah, who wouldn't? So the first question I want to ask of our panel is, when you enter a bookshop, which region do you go to first? Zemiro?
Self-help. I really do. I'm drawn to it. I can't, you know, you go, I'm not going to go to Danish crime again, and I'm not going to go to theatre anymore, don't care, and I'm not going to go to the new stuff. And I find myself drawn to self-help, in all manner of self-help. It could be from procrastination to yoga to something a bit daggier. But yeah, I don't mind the self-help. I know, I shock myself.
So does your bookshop actually have a Danish crime section?
Crime's divided up now. It's divided up. There's sort of
Danish and other.
Scandi. Well, there's Scandi crime, I guess, and then, you know, your Miss Marple crime and your... Yeah, I'll always try and find, you know, a Joan Nesbo book that I could possibly read, which I never can.
Mm. I normally go to the sale bin. That's my first...
Oh, really?
I've got this thing. Like, I've got an actual thing.
Is that where Lee's remaindered books live?
That's where the books that I've signed for her end up. I've got a witchy thing. You know how you're born with a strange talent? Well, mine is I can go into a sales bin, even in a, like a full remainder bookshop, and I will find gold. Some of my
like
favourite
Fiedler's
books.
Like
my book. I had this experience. I was, Kate Kennedy, who's a brilliant Australian short story writer, told me, she was talking about the difference between embarrassment and mortification. She said she was walking past a bookshop and her first volume of poetry was there in the kind of the second-hand remainder bin, and she walked past it thinking, that's just so embarrassing and sad. But then she thought, she walked up the road, she thought, had that awful thought, I'm going to go back and see if I've written an inscription in it, just to see if it's any worse. She walked back, opened the cover, and she said, it said, to dear mum and dad.
That is not true.
It happened. It definitely happened.
Wow.
Kate Kennedy said so, and it must be true.
Wow.
All right, well, where do we find you, Tim?
Well, absurdly, I had the same answer. I go to... I find myself drawn to self-help and well, at least, yeah, self-help and... diet and diet stuff, because neither of those genres of literature ever help anyone, and we buy more of it than anything else. So I'm always interested to see what scam artist is selling books.
Do you buy them?
No, never.
Ah, okay. Because, you know, like, if you want to get really depressed, you look at the cookbooks that sell, because, apart from my more piercing works, I think the main, you know, the things that are about the gut are the ones that are really at the northernmost tip of
That's what I'm reading now, Gut by Julia Enders. Because it's self-help. If you can help your gut, you help yourself. That's what I say.
Yeah. I just feel that if I get to the point where I'm thinking a lot about my gut, I need to get out a bit more.
No. Yeah. No.
Sales, have you ever bought a diet book? Or
No, I'm with Tim. I mean, I just look at that stuff and just complete... Yeah. With contempt.
I think a lot about writing both a self-help book and a diet book. The diet book would just be called Calories Out, Calories In.
Exactly.
The first page would go, if you want to get thin, get more calories coming out and less going in.
Exactly.
And if you want to put on a bit of weight, put some more calories in and don't do as much. And then the rest could just be like pictures of chickens.
Exactly.
Malcolm Turnbull already did that for you. Remember when he lost all that weight and it was partly because he was drinking mysterious... brews, you know, teas and things. He said, you know, the thing is, I discovered that really I just needed to stop eating. And so I just didn't eat for a bit. Yeah. And Lucy would give me a piece of fish if I felt a little faint.
Coincidentally, did his politics shift to the right for the same reason at the same time as well?
That's right, it was a starvation.
Hungry, grumpy.
Yeah. What about, well, sales?
Look,
I go
to new release fiction, actually, because I think a lot about death. Yeah. And I know that...
I think a lot about your death.
As Helen Garner wrote, you know, I am now the possessor of a lengthening past and a shortening future. And I fear that, like, all these great books come out all the time, and there's all these great books that have already been written, and I'm just full of panic by the fact that I can't keep on top of it. The time available is fast getting away from me. And so the stuff that's already been written, I just have to let go of. And so I go to the new release fiction in the hopes that I can just catch up and bloody get on top of it.
Wow.
Exhausting.
Look,
exhausting.
I'm told Tim Minchin's new diet book's going to be quite brief.
Yeah, so very brief.
That'll save you some time. Brief. Well, look, okay, this is the feeling of anxiety associated with being a reader. I mean, if you seriously want to get in, around as much stuff as you can, you live in paranoia. Do you get to the point where there is a great book or a great writer that you just accept that you're never going to get to? Or are there books that you feel incredibly guilty about not getting to? I know my friend Lee Sales caused just almost a near riot here 2 years ago or so by saying, I've got to the point where I'm just not going to read Dickens. And I thought you were going to get just
it was
assassinated.
Ugly.
Yeah.
Yep. It was ugly. Yeah.
Anything that you feel bad about not having read?
Oh, God, yes. This is a wonderful thing to do, this show, because it meant I had to go and have a good, hard look at my bookshelf before I came into this thing here. And there's some books there that stand there and look at you because they've been unread. I've had three goes at trying to read Heart of Darkness. And Heart of Darkness is a book I know I ought to like. I like the whole idea. What I've heard about it is so attractive, but there's something about Conrad's, I don't know, slightly ornate style of writing that just I find really soporific, and it just makes me sort of go to sleep. I've never gotten past the first chapter. So it sits there alongside the first volume of Proust's A la Recherche du Temps Perdu, alongside Herodotus, and they sit there, and they're like people I owe money to. Yeah. they sit there on my bookshelf just glowering at me, saying, well, what are you doing? You know, you bought me. I'm here. Everyone says I'm amazing. What's wrong with you, Feidler? What's the matter with you? Are you stupid? You're stupid, aren't you? That's what my bookshelf is saying to me.
Where is your bookshelf? Can your bookshelf see you watching Netflix?
It can.
Oh, that's worse.
It can. Nah. It can see me looking at unworthy internet sites as well. It's terrible. It's horrible. I'm not well.
Right, well, what about you, Minchin?
Yeah, I got onto Dickens a few years ago.
Where'd you start? Because I'm asking for a friend.
Great Expectations. Yeah. It's good. It's very readable.
It's very
good.
It's
but I try and split. I'm interested in you guys. I try and do fiction, non-fiction, pretty much 50-50.
Right. Yep.
And so there's books like A Brief History of Time and The Selfish Gene, and books I'm just like, for someone like me, sort of obsessed by that stuff, the fact I haven't read The Selfish Gene is absurd, you know. But
do you have The Selfish Gene?
I've got it, yeah. Oh, I've got it all, man. I mean, I've got so much non-fiction, and a lot of it, like books that have had big impacts on me, I've only read the first third. The thing with non-fiction is often the thesis is explicit in the first chapter or two, and that, like, Guns, Germs and Steel is absolute class, you know, but I feel like I picked up what he was putting down, and the rest was going to be firming up his argument.
Yep, I totally agree.
I'm just like, Jared, I believe you.
Same with The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman. It's a newspaper column extended into a whole book. You read chapter one of The World is Flat, you got the idea.
Yeah, you got it. And so I do that a bit, but at least I've read enough of Guns, Germs and Steel to understand the thesis and go, yeah, it sounds about right to me.
If these people were serious, they'd release the executive summary, wouldn't they? And then it would save us all a lot of
just
time.
Just do the cliff notes.
But the upshot of that, though, is you might then read a review of the book and say, well, I don't agree with this guy's thesis at all. And you've got to go, oh, Christ, now I've got to read the whole book.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. What percentage of Brief History of Time copies ever sold have been read cover to cover, do you reckon?
Now, there was a lot of commentary about this around Hawking's death because there was a whole lot of people saying, and of course, I haven't read it. You know, oh, you neither? Oh, okay. No one's read it, apart from apparently you. So.
I haven't read it. Brief History of Time. No, that's one of my guilt books. I want a briefer history of time. I want a less time-consuming history of time. I haven't read Fatal Shore. That's one I might got to do.
It's sitting next to my bed, and it's been there for about 3 years because found it at the market. Yeah. Jeremy and I both went, you've got to read that, and neither of us has.
I bet you there's certain authors that would be highly featured on the guilt list, like Robert Hughes, like The Shock of the New would be another one that I think, I really want to read that, and it's just always...
I've read both those books, and I really enjoyed them, and it wasn't a problem. It's okay. Both those books are wonderful.
I know they will be. And
see, now you're the smart ass at the party.
Yeah. 100 Years of Solitude. I've got 70 years through twice. Like, I'm just like, there's more characters in there. I don't know if they're real or not. I'm going to kill myself. Whereas I have no problem with Midnight's Children, which also has 100
characters. I hated Midnight's Children.
Well, I loved it. I've got a very... I don't really love magic realism at all. So I'm always genuinely surprised when I enjoy a representative of it.
Well, I kind of went through a rushdie phase in my mid-20s trying to be a smart person.
Yes. Did you read the Satanic Verses, though?
I never read Satanic Verses.
See, nobody read that.
I read Midnight Children and Ground Beneath Her Feet, weirdly, is my other one I like.
I didn't like that at all.
Yeah, no, most people didn't.
I wonder if we'll be friends. Okay. Zemiro?
I think I should read the Bible, but I haven't. Because I'm not... No, seriously, because I think there's so many references in literature and I just can't get past it. But a book... Now, I thought we were all supposed to bring our books and no one did, except for me. I thought you were supposed to bring all the books that you were going to talk about tonight. So I'm quite disappointed.
Prize.
But the one that you and Lee bang on about all the time is Lolita.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I could have never been able to get past the first page. Lola, Lolita, discovering I couldn't give a tinker's cuss. So this is going to be like a book library.
One of the greatest first pages of a novel of all time.
Anyway, that's like a street book library there. That's if anybody wants to pick that up on the way through, they can. And the other ones, all the Ferrante books. I can't get into the...
I know.
Kill me.
Dickens,
so I'm just going to leave that there as well. You can't have them. They're mine. But they're ones I just can't get into, and I'll let it go. And they're not particularly highfalutin, but I just... And I know he's writing in his third language, Nabokov, well done, but I just... I mean, I've never related... When I was a young woman, I couldn't relate to the girl, I couldn't relate to the guy. I don't... And with my brilliant friend, I can't...
Crowd reckons his name's pronounced Nabokov.
It is Nabokov.
Is it really?
Yanipunimayu.
That's how she gets the French president on
side. I don't understand. I wish I could, but I can't.
Okay. Mm. And do you have any shame books that you've got in, great writers that you don't really get into, or any books that are, you know, Pulitzer Prize winners or Booker Prize winners, and you go, yes, it's supposed to be marvellous, but geez, I don't get it at all. Like, I just did not love Midnight in the Bardo.
Lincoln in the Bardo, it's called,
sorry,
actually, love.
Lincoln in the Bardo.
And Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, probably, as well, I'm guessing.
Lincoln in the Garden of Good and Evil.
What was Lincoln doing in the Bardo at midnight?
Yeah. Why is this about LinkedIn? I don't get it.
Did he have his pants on? I don't know.
He's so clever, and everybody in the world is so convinced that it's a work of genius, and then it won the Booker Prize. I'm like,
I didn't like it.
I'm an idiot. I'm an idiot.
Well, no, it's just your taste.
Yeah, I guess so.
That's all right.
But the interesting thing about...
She just said you have idiotic taste. Did you notice that?
The interesting thing about prizes is they establish this sort of infrastructure of literature, don't they? I mean, it's the global expression of everybody except you thinks this is wonderful. And I find, do you know, I will often not read something because it's won the Booker Prize.
Wow.
And so I will quite often, this happens to me, and I'll find a book somehow, I'll get onto it, I'll read it. I think, this is brilliant! And I'll be telling everybody I know, and they'll say, well, that won the Booker Prize 5 years ago, you tool.
Annabella's refused to listen to ABBA ever since they won the Eurovision Song Contest in 1973. Well, she's somehow done it. I don't know.
The Strays by Emily Bitter, which won the Stella Prize last year, I only just recently read it, and I was like, but this is awesome! This is such a great book!
Yeah.
And
expect it'll be a bit dry. That, when I see Booker Prize, I go, I'll buy it and I'll trawl through it, and when they're really easy, I'm shocked. You know, when I find it easy to get through.
Yeah. Mm. So, what's your secret shame then? What genre or what book do you love secretly, knowing that it's trash, or that it means a bad thing about you that you love?
Spy thrillers, like
spy thrillers.
Secretly want to be one, like a spy, and I want to write one. because it's just always rollicking good fun, like spy thrillers.
You should
thrillers
be quiet
just
about that. You're ruining your chances right here. See, I am one, but I'm not going to say it out loud. So dumb.
No, I just love the, like, you know,
what did
like
you say in a podcast recently? You did a shout, well, ages ago actually, but you did a shout out. You were like wanting a spy to come and talk to you. You said it on our podcast. If you are a spy, come up to me and say, I'm an accountant, and then we'll both know, and I'll be able to get to know you, but we won't have to. And then you did say that. It's not my
imagination. I did, but I can't remember why I wanted a spy to come up to me. But interestingly, somebody did. Somebody
did. They?
Yeah, you're Lisa the accountant. Yeah. So somebody did. Yeah. Come up and just went, hey, I'm an accountant. And I had no idea what they're talking about. I was like, so? And they're like, you know, an accountant?
And then she drove me to Allianz Stadium.
That was concerning. Yeah. So this was some random who came up to me and Annabelle and was a spy. And well, she wasn't really a spy. She worked in sort of debriefing people who did undercover stuff. And then Crab, we were then a while later at the front of this venue. Crab needed to get out to Homebush and we're sort of like, oh, well, I guess you could go to the train. And then she just went, hello? I could take you. And so then Crab goes with her. I'm thinking, I'm a little bit worried about this, but it's fine. She got to Homebush and, and someone gave you a free meal as well.
That's right. It was a really good night.
It was
actually
a great day.
Yeah, a lot of free stuff.
Well, you wouldn't believe it, Tim. You really wouldn't. What's your secret shame?
Oh, Reacher.
Who?
Jack Reacher.
Lee Child, yeah. I think I've read most of them.
Oh, okay.
So when I say alternate fiction, non-fiction, I also alternate hard work and trash. Well, not alternate, but I've read, and Grisham as well.
Oh, I love John Grisham.
But the Reacher ones are weird because
I'm so cool that I didn't even know what you were talking
about. Yeah, so Jack Reacher's probably one of the biggest selling series in the world.
Right.
Like, surely, right?
Yeah.
And there are moments where you're just like, oh my God, the big tall guy beats up other guys. And that's basically all that happens. And then every now and then there's like two pages where Lee Child's like stretching his legs and it's like, you're like, this guy can write, you know. And not only his story structure is always good because it's a formula, but every now and then you're just like, wow, this is proper. Lee Child.
So do you
It's say, pretty bad. I mean, it's really bad.
You know how you do 50-50 non-fiction fiction, you obviously do a certain proportion of schlock to highbrow or whatever. Is that deliberate? I mean, is it like an exercise regime where you go, oh, like I've read a bit of fiction recently, so I've got to go back to non-fiction?
Well, what do you mean? Like, do you think I just crunch the data on my history and realise that I did that?
I think it's a regime. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Because I think... Men especially read a lot of non-fiction. I think as you get older, you drift towards it because you start getting the panic that you don't know enough.
Yeah.
But I just think it's... I think reading... You can get yourself in a habit of just doing one or the other, so I try to...
I read about 9 times non-fiction to fiction, but the books that I've really loved, the books that I think I really novels. Remember are fiction, are novels.
Yeah.
They're the ones that affect you very deeply. And you go back to reread and you think about them all the time. They're all novels. It's just an odd paradox I can't explain.
Mm. Yeah.
I got out of the habit of reading novels for a while there because for work, you know, like every single Australian politician now writes a memoir. Like it's just part of your induction, really. It's just like find a publisher, sell 600 copies. I mean, it's, And so...
And they're almost by definition the least interesting people, are they?
I'm not as preoccupied with the seniority or the level of interest of the person. I just want them to really blow themselves up in a memoir. And that doesn't really happen.
Yeah.
If you read a memoir by a politician who is still in office, it will be boring. That is, in fact...
Or anyone who's still got something to lose.
Right. Mm. The way that you knew that Hillary Clinton was running for president was that you picked up that book and read it and
went, clean.
You are still in the business because there is no... bomb in here.
Nothing in there.
Yeah.
I've never read a good politician's memoir. Never. Apparently Barack Obama's one is great, but I've never read a good one. Not one that's really powerful and revealing.
Alan Clark's diaries are the greatest political memoir I've ever read. They are rude, they are funny, they are revealing, and he blows himself up on every page. Mind you, this is the guy who was...
He's a psychopath. Yes, he was actually a psychopath.
Yes,
John Le Carré was friends with him for a while, and Le Carré had to sack him as a friend because he was such a disgusting human being.
Yes.
Well, that, they make good books. Though.
He has nothing to lose. I mean, the Latham Diaries were a great read.
Watch your mouth. Watch your mouth. Wash it.
I'm not looking forward to the cookbook with Alan Jones, though, which is just...
That's out, I think.
Latham
and Jones have done a cookbook.
That is actually real, isn't it? That's not some weird Photoshop bullshit thing, is it?
No,
that's actually going to happen?
Actually a thing.
Right.
Yeah. So,
I guess that's
can I talk about my guilty pleasure?
Yes, please.
It's any book based on wanting to live in France. So, you know, they do all those things. Oh, maybe I didn't even bring it. So, you know, there's all those, because I hate them. I read them for pure, And, you know, it started with my year in Provence and, you know, then French women don't get fat, but then again, French women don't have any friends, so... then it moves on to all these different... The only good one is the Almost French book that Sarah Turnbull wrote years ago, because she is just trying to find her way through France. It's nothing about being posh. She's just a journalist. She wants to get on with people. She wants to get on with her husband's friends. They don't like her for another 3 years till they decide we can trust you. It's honest. It's honest. It's
is
not painting
Chocolat
it.
Is Chocolat a terrible book?
I haven't read it. Because that's a novel. I'm talking about
people going,
I've lived in France, non-fiction stuff about how to be French in France and how hard it is and all the funny things the French do and I'm English and I'm American and these are the differences and who cares?
And why do you read them? Why are you driven to
Because
them?
They drive me insane and I think they're wrong and I'll go on that. I have so many of them. I buy them. It's wrong.
Scab picking.
I've always wanted to live in Paris and I've never found an excuse to be able to do it. And I avoid those goddamn books for exactly the same reason you're attracted to them, because, you know, there'll be some woman on the cover with some pinafore on going, well, I've done well, haven't I? I'm in Paris, it's nice, it's great, and I can cook like a French person. Wasn't easy at first, but I'm fine now. They're all the same.
But they do it because they want to live in France and they think, what's the reason to do it? They go, I could write a book about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. I mean, but they sell to idiots like me.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to sprinkle a few ethical questions throughout the event. And my first one is, is it ever okay to fold the page over to mark your spot?
No.
I have a complicated set of rules around this. No. Never?
No.
Yes, always.
Always.
I've made notes. I've got sticky notes. I've got things in the margin to remind myself. Ooh. It's my book and I can do what I want with it. I paid for it. It's mine.
This was your going to bed book 1 month when you were very tired, wasn't it? Because every second one is been folded down.
No, they're all things I like. And I've had to mark it and go, oh, that's terrific. Oh, what a great idea. Oh, yes,
can
do
I
it that way.
That? That looks good, that book.
Yeah, so it's called The Odd Woman in the City, as opposed to Sex in the City, and it's written by an older woman. It's about walking around New York, and she's a writer, Vivian Gornick, and sometimes it's a paragraph, and sometimes it's a story, and she has no children like I do, and she was single, and I was single for a long time, and I just love it. It's like a little, and it's the light book you can put in your bag and you can read on the bus and stuff without having to carry a tome.
Have you reread it a bunch of times?
Well, as you can tell, heaps of times.
Okay.
Heaps and heaps.
You see, I carry around a bunch of bookmarks with me in case I see someone reading one of my books. And they're about to fold the page over like, like that,
Because you feel
anal
like
retentive, I don't think so.
No. Because you feel like it's an extension of your body.
Yes, it is. I mean, I actually spent a lot of time talking with the publishers about making it a beautiful object. Something that you... I'm a bit fetishistic about books, as you may have gathered. So holding this thing is such a lovely... it has to be a beautiful thing in my mind. And then to go, like that. It's like slapping me across the face.
I think you're doing a disservice to the book by... It's like the fable of the kid with the pencil going, look around, I haven't used my pencil. Like I feel the same about musical instruments. Always people are precious with their pianos. I'm like, piano's meant to be something that you hit and interact with and put your mug on, and you obviously don't want tea in the strings, but it's the same with books. If they look like that, that means it's brought joy, and if it's pristine, it might as well still be in the book.
Might be one of those ones that's reproaching Richard from the shelves.
I feel the same way as you do about musical instruments. It's just books, and I don't know what that's about. And probably years of therapy required to get to the bottom of that, I'm afraid.
Well, we're going to deal with it today.
Okay,
Richard.
Thank you.
We'll give him a book that hasn't been touched and make him fold a page. Have you got one that's pristine? Well, give my children to my brilliant friend.
Yeah, my brilliant friend.
Take it from her.
My brilliant friend, because I don't care.
Take it from her. Oh my God, it's Elena Ferrante too.
Okay, you're getting sleepy. It's page 95.
If you don't
fold it over, I'll rip the page up. I will fucking do it.
No, too far.
There's been so many of these made, I'll use it for fire. Just
you've cracked the spine, so it's broken already.
Oh. You can do it, Richard.
There we go.
Richard. Baby steps, mate.
And now it's worthless.
Yes. Fantastic.
I think we've travelled a long way. Yeah. Oh, Lee Sales, you'll do all sorts of reprehensible things to books, including throw them in the bin.
I don't throw them. Where did this myth take hold that I throw them in the bin? I don't throw books in the actual bin. I just give them away or I give them to the universe.
Is part of the universe a bin?
Most of it, as far as I can tell.
Crab's just filthy because she found a book she'd inscribed for me in the recycling.
True story.
Yes, I did. So now I've taken the step of writing inscriptions in any book that I give to Lee that include her home address and phone number throughout the book, just so that if it's ever found in a, you know...
See, I'm not sentimental. Like, when I went to interview James Comey, the former FBI
director... Wow, I can't believe it took you until 6 minutes
amazing.
Past five to...
So I got two copies
Talk
of the
among
book.
Yourselves for a moment.
I got two copies of the book and I got them both signed for friends and gave them away. And one of the friends, who's the sort of person who loves getting signed books, she's a big student of American politics, so she was thrilled to get this, said to me, did you get one for yourself? I was like, nah. She's like, what? Why would you not get James Comey to sign a book for yourself? I don't care. Like, I don't... He's just a human being.
And you slept with him too. So you got what you...
I told you not to tell anyone about
that. I'm a terrible spy.
God. Well,
I was there. I'll never forget.
Wow.
So
you're one of those Martha Hari type spies.
Mate, just because I slept with you to get you to do 7:30 doesn't mean I do it for everyone.
I assume that was fun.
Right.
Well, that escalated quickly. There's been enough scandal here.
There's a lot going on. He's folded a page. She's had sex with the head of the FBI.
I've got a whole bit of bookshelf that is just books whose authors have written, like, personalised the book to me. Even books that I hate, people
book.
I barely know.
Yeah.
I hate the thought of that person somehow then finding that book when I've given it
so
to someone.
So you're only moral because you're observed?
Yes, absolutely.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
I just recently moved house and I actually desecrated some books because they were just books I just didn't want at all but had really nice inscriptions. So I actually just tore out the inscription.
Oh, yeah, I've done that.
And
then
put it out for recycling.
Yeah.
Wow.
While my wife was screaming at me. She was going, don't do that, don't do that. That's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm also messy though. So, like, by habit, I don't throw books out.
Yeah.
But, you know, that is the. How do you organise your books, by the way? I mean, is it.
Subject categories. Subject categories. I've got American history section, Australian history section, European, Russia, French. I know. Whole row of Penguin Classics because it looks nice,
that kind of row
of black. Yeah. You know, that row of black that's there and you just want to add to it all the time. And
Lovely.
And rows of my embarrassing guilty pleasure, superhero comics.
Of course. I'll raise you an asterisk.
Yeah. Oh, I love asterisks.
And that spine is broken, but, you know, in French, obs. And this one's Asterix and Cleopatra, and it was, I think, one of the first time they had a woman in the book, so that got exciting. There's actually a female in the book, but yeah, Cleopatra, who knew? Oh, great fun.
That's sort of like a date book. That's so sexy that you've got that. Like, I've got my interesting French comics.
And there's still chocolate. Like, I used to read it first thing in the morning, my parents would be asleep, and I'd sneak down to the kitchen because my dad had a restaurant and find that huge chunk of chocolate that he would cut bits off to make chocolate mousse out or whatever. Yeah. And I'd try and get a little bit and go upstairs and eat, and there's still chocolate stains in the book.
Oh.
Yeah, it's nice. I've got terrible teeth, though.
Well, we're talking about how to handle books, and I could really quiz you extensively on these, as my book organisation system is probably the strangest, which is that I categorise books as according to the order in which I acquired them. Mm-hmm. So I can remember... I read that book, I got that when I was at university or when I was living here or whatever. And so for years, every time I moved house, I'd unpack them all, you know, in the correct order.
How do you remember? How do you keep track?
Because I remember because where I was when I read it, or what frame of mind, or which part of my life I was in. And I can always remember where I was when I read a book. In fact, where I am when I read a book has a huge influence on the extent to which I enjoy it and remember it, which is kind of weird. But anyway, I had a house guest a couple of years ago who, as a favour, reorganised my book shelves.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And it looked much tidier, and I've never been able to find anything again. But I've now gone into fiction, non-fiction, you know, American politics, British politics. So, yeah. There you go. It's over now.
What about people who organise them by colour?
Yeah, see, I just think you haven't read any of them if you're organising them by colour.
Yeah.
Or you've read them all and you think, oh, well, I'll just make them organise them by colour.
It's for some reason that's become in vogue. Because when I sold my house a few years ago...
I was going to say, it's only done by people who are selling their house.
Yeah. The person who zhuzhed it up to make it look nice, because, of course, it was just a hovel the way I lived in it... organised all of the books by colour, and then it got written in the paper that I was moving house, and I was mortified to think, oh, people think I organise my books by colour.
Yeah. I still think that, even though you're
I'm surprised that when the Australian published your home address when you bought a new house recently, thanks very much, that their lead wasn't "and the slag organises her books by colour." Yeah.
My favourite thing about, I think I've shared it publicly before, any coverage of my personal affairs was that it noted that somebody wrote a piece noting that I was moving to a suburb that, you know, was a little, not Sydney's most expensive suburb because of the extreme aircraft noise and the proximity of other ABC celebrities such as Annabelle Crabb.
I was actually reported as a downward pressure on housing prices.
It's good to know.
It seemed harsh, I thought.
It's funny.
But look, I don't want to disappear into the rut of book management because I also want to talk turkey, I want to talk titles. And I would like to know, because I'm an inveterate rereader of books, which is the book that you reread the most often?
Well,
apart from that one with all the mad folding.
I know. Unfortunately, it is The Handmaid's Tale. And I know people will think that's because it's out now. It's not. That's an old copy. It's not got anything new on the front. Mm. I have to say, as a childless woman, I was very fascinated by the whole story of it when I first read it, I should say, in my 30s. And it made me think a lot about having children, and it seemed so real. It seemed so real. And I'm, you know, delighted it's turned into a TV show. But every year I read it just because I can't quite believe it. And I love how she writes, obviously. I've got most of Margaret Atwood's stuff. But I just... You just feel like you're with her. You're with Offred the whole time and you understand her. And then I just think the genius of it is the last chapter that is not in the TV series because they wanted to make a second one. Mm. And that's so annoying.
That is annoying.
Because now it's gone really ugly and dark. And not that the first story isn't dark and ugly, but that last chapter I think is genius because it's... Spoiler, can I say, roughly? Yeah, basically, it's an academic looking back on that period. And again, it's about how do we report on history, and it's a man reporting on history, I think. Mm. And it's, depending on what you want to believe, you believe she might still be alive or she might have met a dreadful fate, so we don't need series two of The Handmaid's Tale.
I'm always... a lot of actors out of work, thanks.
Yeah, and I'm always surprised by it. I know it. Hmm. But I'm still genuinely surprised and genuine... And I love her voice. I love the character, yeah. So, the end.
Fidler?
Two books for me. Wuthering Heights. And, surrenders new meaning all the time to me. It's just it's the most perfectly strange masterpiece I've ever read. There's so much in it, and I think about it all the time, as a kind of an essay on human nature and how it might be twisted and distorted like one of those windblown trees on the heath.
I have reread that book a few times and I can't stop just wanting it to be different. I'm like, Kathy, snap out of it.
I mean, I remember really... reading it for the first time, just there's Mr. Lockwood, who's this genial idiot who goes up to Wuthering Heights and sees Heathcliff there and then has to stay the night on the second visit and is lying in Kathy's bed reading that journal, then falls and has this nightmare where there's the branch tapping on the window pane, tap, 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 and it becomes so bothersome to him. He, in the dream, he smashes his hand through the window pane to grasp the branch and break it, and instead feels the hand of a child who's saying, let me in, let me in. And she won't let go of him, and so he rubs her wrist against the broken pane of glass. And I'm thinking, my God, this is the most... You know, it's early Victorian literature. This is just remarkable. The imagination that created... From those three sisters living in an isolated farmhouse, exposed to whatever culture they could find. I was talking to my co-author of Sagaland, Kari Gisus, and Kari was telling me that the Bronte sisters really hated Jane Austen as an author. They were aware of her and didn't like her work. I think you can love both at the same time for different reasons, but Wuthering Heights is one of those books that renders such strange and startling images of Kathy being hurled out of heaven and landing on the kind of the rain on the hills, you know, crying with gratitude to be she being too heaven being too good for her and being preferring to be on Wuthering Heights. And the other book I reread every, I don't know, 5-10 years or so is Anna Karenina, which surrenders new meaning all the time. And reading it as a young man, reading it as a middle-aged man, you read the personalities very differently, I think. I love that about that book.
Mm. Good answers.
That's on my list. Anna Karenina's on my guilt list.
On your guilt list?
Yeah.
Oh, it's such an easy thing. Like, Tolstoy has this reputation, these big tomes, and they're challenging, and they're Russian, and what have you, and you know, you pick them up with some trepidation, and then you read the first page, and then you're just doing that after a while. Yeah. They read like that. They're unputdownable.
Mm. They are. Yeah. And the thing that's also freaks me out about Anna Karenina is I just think Tolstoy, amazing to be a man of his era writing so incredibly perceptively about a woman. Like, I just think...
Ah, well, there's a story behind that. He said in his letters, in writing this, Tolstoy said, I want to write a book that's essentially a novel that's kind of a moral instruction about a fallen woman, and it's to kind of heap shame on this kind of a woman. That was his intent, but as he began to write this novel, his moral imagination fell in step with the character so much, he ultimately writes this incredibly sympathetic novel. And that's what makes it art, as opposed to some intolerable tirade. I think that's fascinating. I love the idea how the literary imagination brings the author from this shocking old finger-wagging Russian aristocrat into creating a great work of art. And what a mysterious process that is.
And to develop a sympathy for your character as you're writing must be such a magical...
Standing backstage and Sales said empathy is imagination, and so you know, you might have an objective view, but you can't go into a character's head and question what her actions are going to be without your imagination kicking in. What would it be like if... And then empathy hits you like a frickin' truck and then you write something nice. Mm-hmm. People should imagine being other people more, eh?
Yeah, well...
Frickin' simple.
As long as you're not... robbing them of their identities.
Right? Yes.
Hey, listen, are you a book rereader yourself, Tim? You sound a frenetic dasher through...
No, I'm not. I'm sitting here. I'm really good at pretending to be as smart as the people around me. I get away with it all the time. I don't read as much as you guys. I'm not as fast and I fall asleep very quickly. I only read at night. So I'm certainly not frenetic, but I do find it hard to go, I'll reread a book when I've got all my... I've got, I reckon, a third of the books in my house I haven't read, because I buy books with the intention to read them and that I'm not keeping up with my purchase rate.
When I say frenetic, I don't mean like fast reader, but you seem like a hungry reader.
No,
like
I'm trying to gather knowledge. Yeah. I really like... You know, my favourite book is rather cliche, but my favourite book of the last few years is Sapiens, which...
I haven't read that.
Oh. Well, maybe we'll talk about it later. But
My wife's reading it now, and she's raving about it, talking about it just, every day to me.
It's just fantastic. Yeah. And it's just big picture look at humanity. It's non-fiction. And same... I sort of feel guilty rereading books, but I doubt I've read any novel in the world more than twice. I think I've read like a couple of the Vonnegut, you know, Slaughterhouse and Cat's Cradle. Yeah. Maybe Cat's Cradle I've read 3 times. Just I read it at uni and then went back to it and went, oh, that's not what I remember, and then read it for fun. And you know, Kill a Mockingbird I've read a couple of times, and Yeah, like a few little things, but I tend to go, shit, what's next, yeah.
Yeah, okay. What about you, Sal?
I definitely was more of a rereader when I was younger, so by far the most read books of my life are children's books that I would reread over and over. Yeah. So Anne of Green Gables, Magic Faraway Tree, you know, each of them I would have read a dozen times at least.
Did you want to be Anne of Green Gables?
Yeah, yeah, damn right. Straight.
Yeah.
I went to... when
you
I
kind
lived,
of are.
When I went to the US, I went on holiday to Prince... when I lived there, to Prince Edward Island, purely because I was such a fan. Like, and it was thrilling. It was one of the greatest things I've ever done.
Overdo
it. Just makes me want to cry. God, you're a wretch.
Did you ever want to be a character in a book that you read, Tim?
You're sort of Anne of Green Gables too.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, but you're your own exotic character now.
I like strong young girls. Like, I do like Matilda.
Out of context,
stuff.
That would really not work.
Oh, I like it. In any context, that statement probably is true. Yeah, the how young is depends on contents, but like I love young children. You know, obviously I love Matilda, and yeah. I love young children's characters that are female, like gutsy,
with
young.
A bit of sass.
But I think probably as a kid it was Dick that I was attracted to.
As in from Dick and Dora?
No, Dick from the Famous Five. No, I just wanted to be one of the Famous Five, like
yeah.
Catching
George.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
And I didn't want to be George because she had depression and gender identity issues. And
Anne was sort of a boring.
Anne was kind of soft. And yeah. Julian was really self-righteous and rather... And so Dick just got on with it. And so either that's Timmy, the dog, obviously, yeah. which I named my band after years later, or Dick. Yeah.
Dick, yeah. That's a really interesting
choice. When I was reading The Magic Faraway Tree to my kids, I realised that Dick and Fanny had turned into Rick and Franny.
No.
And
no.
Yeah, they have.
What?
They've become Rick and Franny rather than Dick and Fanny.
Oh.
Dick and Fanny going up the tree together and all that. And I just, you have to...
Are you for real?
I am not joking. I'm right, aren't I? Mean, people, yeah. It's Rick and Franny
now.
You
can't call them Dick and Fanny anymore because that suggests binary gender.
It does, doesn't it? And can you imagine what that editorial meeting in the publishing house was like?
Yes.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, I think we all know why we're here. The whole, we have a Dick and Fanny crisis on our hands. Enid, I'm sure, had meant nothing by it.
Well, I think Biggie is...
Yeah, right. Yeah, Noddy.
I think Noddy required a lot more editing because of the G word as well.
Oh,
I don't
know
if they... God. What do they call them now?
I don't know.
I've never read any of those Famous Five books. So I don't know what they are.
No, they're not amazing now. Though my kids have read them, and I've read them to my kids because they're such a big part of my childhood. And you have to. But what's great is they are full of teachable moments about how times have changed. And like, what do you? You know, I say to my daughter, what do you think about what George feels about not wanting to be called Georgina? Or what do you think about Anne wanting to stay and make the lashings of cream and not go out on the adventures? And so it's fine.
When
you just have to put it in
context.
When they
go and find a cave to live in, she's constantly tidying it.
Yeah, tidying
like,
a cave.
You're in a cave. Yeah.
See, it all feels like sexual innuendo to me.
Well,
stay at home and tidy your cave.
I'm going to campaign to bring... I'm in a campaign to bring back sex and violence into children's folk tales, which is the original versions had so much of them.
You've been thinking about Iceland too much. That's
maybe so.
Vikings up
but no, the original versions of stories like Little Red Riding Hood are really wrong stories.
Yeah.
Before I had kids of mine, I was reading a story to a friend's child once, and he had a kind of an updated version of The Boy Who Cried Wolf. And in this version, the boy was lonely, and he cries wolf to attract attention. And eventually, of course, the wolf does come. He cries out. He's believed. Dad or the townspeople come along. They don't kill the wolf. They capture him and send him on his way somewhere. And then the dad realises the reason why the boy was doing this, because he was lonely, so he gets given a puppy for company. And I asked this kid, Jai, what did you get out of the story? And I'm not making this up. I swear to God, not a word changed. She said, if you tell a lot of lies, you get a dog.
Yeah. That's true. He nailed it. That is the tale in that tale.
It is. It's the moral of that story.
Or you become a president.
That. Yeah.
What character do you want to be? Are you in a... I'd love to know what...
So I grew up on a farm, as you know, because you've been there.
Yes.
And you provided my dad with the happiest day of his entire life, including the day of my
birth. Whoa.
We did a home purpose. I've taken Lee and I've taken Annabelle back to their childhood homes on home delivery, and we were just saying earlier that Annabelle is one of the few guests we had on where her parents and her family still live in their family home. It's so, so rare. So we never got that sense of her surprise at refinding this house, but it made everybody in the crew cry because we all wished we lived in this house and had this, you know, beautiful history with this house.
And my dad, who, like, every man
in his
has
mid-50s and over,
incredible crush on Julia Zemiro, got to have her come to his house. And at one heady moment, you sat on his knee and that...
holding
a boiled crab.
Boiled
because
crab.
My dad, who is highly literal, likes crabbing, cooking and catching crabs and consuming them with beer on very hot days. And,
That's so weird. I have American...
What character would you like to be?
Oh, sorry. I want to hear the answer to this one.
Because I used to waft around the farm. I used to sort of pretentiously take a book and read in the haystack and stuff. And I really thought that I was Sibylla from My Brilliant Career.
Good choice.
Yeah, I really, really got... I would have been annoying, I think, to talk to about it at the time, but...
Got the hair for it too, though. That's very Sibylla hair.
Oh, yeah. No, I really felt
in
that.
In the film, sorry, not the book.
Speaking of which, has anyone ever been thoroughly happy with the adaptation of a book into a film?
Yes, the because original miniseries of Anne of Green Gables starring Megan Follows. Oh, my God.
Megan Follows.
It was like... It was just everything you'd ever imagined. It was so flawless and note perfect. They just utterly nailed it.
Right. Can I do a play?
Yeah.
I think Cloud Street, the play, was unbelievable.
Yeah. God, that was
four
fabulous.
To 5 hours in the theatre. Yeah. Went like that.
Yeah.
To see Dan Wiley go off at the end and then jump in the water.
Yeah.
The incredible cast, you just go, oh, God, I love these Australian actors so much. And it was like pure, amazing
music.
Story. It was... Amazing.
Black Swan Theatre Company.
Yeah, it's where it began. Yeah, yeah.
Westchester.
And we saw it over here. I saw it over here. But it toured and it actually went to New York, I believe. And I actually think went there not after 9/11. That was a beautiful, beautiful.
Anna Karenina, Wuthering Heights, ever been happy with any of that?
No, neither of those things have ever been made. I'm sorry, I hate every time that either of those books has been put on a screen. Wuthering Heights as a song, though, by Kate Bush. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And totally. That bit in the middle eight where she says, oh, let me have it, let me drag your soul away. It's an amazing thing to write in a song. So there is that. But in terms of adaptation to the screen, it's TV rather than film. I have to say Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the BBC version of that, not the film. Not the film.
Right.
That's what the art direction got right out of control there in that film. And it lacked that strange compression and the dinginess of MI6, which Lee now works for, in the late 1970s. That feeling of men meeting in dingy rooms in Cambridge Circus, that feeling of post-war austerity, and Alec Guinness as Smiley is absolutely perfect. That moment when he's this kind of soggy old man who's brought over to Oliver Lakin's house in the home counties and sitting down there with the spy who's got to tell them that there's a mole in the organisation. And Smiley then takes his glasses off, rubs them with the fat end of his tie, as he does. And when he puts them back on, he's a stone-cold spy master. And it's just a thrilling scene, and it's done so subtly.
Can you do your glasses with the thin end of your tie? I mean, that seems like redundant information. He's not going to... It's always going to be the fat end. But, you know... Honestly, adjectives, just more adjectives.
It's true.
On
it's
adaptations, true. I mean, it's so obvious, and I don't mean to blow smoke up your ass, but your adaptation of Matilda was amazing. It was absolutely brilliant.
Oh, good.
And so true to the spirit of it. It was magic.
Tell us.
That's good, thanks.
Can you tell us quickly?
I mean, it's not my adaptation, it's Dennis's adaptation.
One of the best things about your Matilda, apart from going and watching it, is the story of how it kind of came together. Can you quickly just tell us how weird the...
God, you don't really want to hear that story. I mean, when I was in Perth, about the time they were making Cloud Street, and Grandage was like, I wish one day I could do what he's doing.
The musical director, Ian Grant.
He's an incredible composer who I work with a bit nowadays. I was clawing my way, thinking, doing youth theatre and kids theatre and stuff, and I wrote to the Dahl Estate, the first and last time I ever wrote to a literary estate ever about anything, to see... There's just enough internet to be able to find that information. And I went, I'll just write to him and say... How do I get the rights to do Matilda the Musical, thinking I would do what I always do, which is take 4 weeks to write a score and put it on for a week, rehearse for 2 weeks and put it on for a week, and then it goes away and that's it. That's what you do. There was never any intent for it to become anything. And they wrote back and said, we're always interested in adaptations of Roald's work, and please send us a sample score and we'll consider it. And I went, a sample score, what does that mean? Like, you'd have to know how to read music to create one of those. And so I just went, and then it feels like a lifetime. So that would have been 2000. Mm. And a whole lifetime later, I get called into the RSC's office, and by now my comedy cabaret sort of vibe's going well in England, and I had no idea what the meeting was for, and I hadn't sort of taken the time to Google the person I was meeting because I was all up in my own head. And he went, have you heard of, do you know Roald Dahl's work? Yeah. Have you heard of Matilda? Yeah. Well, the RSC is making a musical of it, and your name's come up. And I went, well, if you're going to do an adaptation of Matilda, you'll fuck it up if you do this, this, and you know. I went, anyway, see, you're not going to get me to do it because it's proper people. And then that worked. Mm. But It was only 8 years later, but at the time it felt like I was in a totally different life.
It's the best, here's one I prepared earlier.
Yeah, but I hadn't really thought about it or written any, you know, I never really got round to it. Back in 2000, I was having, and up to 2006, I guess, when we were doing improv and stuff, like, I was just throwing paint at
the last the wall, gig we did together was in Launceston at a corporate event in a marquee, I do believe.
Oh, really? Did we have a marquee? Luxury.
Yeah, we had a car. Yeah.
So I think there's a great lesson out of this. If you are really serious about a book and you love it and you don't want to see anyone mess it up by
do
making
it yourself.
It, just do it yourself. Yeah. And try to be Tim Minchin while you're at it. Do you know what? The tragedy is that we are out of time. That thing is blinking. It says session overtime. It's going to start really swearing. And this is a big deal because the next session is totally sold out as well. So I've been threatened with actual physical violence if I don't cut things off on time. So I'm sorry about that. I feel like we could be here for about 8 hours more.